Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Good morning. It's Sue here. I have just arrived in the studio to find that I don't have a plug for the USB. I'll have a play around and see what I can unplug to put one in. But once I log in,
don't worry, I won't hurt you. I only want you to have some fun.
That would be Prince, partying like it's 1999. I was down at the gathering in 1999. Boy, that was interesting. So today we've got a more party-themed piece.
You don't sing tonight, I think, because tonight, by way of encouragement...
Morning, this is Sue for our post-Christmas Quilted Bananas radio, and I've got with me Sarah, who's going to talk to me about festivals, because it's that season of festivals being upon us, one after another. And this Quilted Bananas program is brought to you by, paid for by the Peter Royal Foundation, for whom we must express our gratitude. They really make this much easier for us. And I think having queer voices on the air is just becoming that much more important nowadays, even if we're talking about things other than queer stuff. It's celebrating people of our community and some pace of what's going on. This is the exact opposite of that, isn't it? Because today my guest is Sarah, and she's going to talk to us about Egyptian festivals. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning. How are you today, Sue?
I'm great.
Yeah. Like, so I'm all for queer voices talking about anything and everything. The more that we just, you know, become just interwoven with everything in society, the happier I am. So...
And sometimes you've got to throw a bit of queer joy around.
Oh, all the time. My goodness, yeah. I think it's... I was listening to someone the other day that was saying it's kind of our duty in some ways. We honour those who went before us by enjoying and celebrating the life we have now whilst we
Having a good time.
Exactly.
So I've spoken to Sarah, I think, a couple of times before, possibly.
Just the once. Ago. Yeah, something, I think, about Egyptian queens, was it?
Yeah, and this time I've asked Sarah to come and talk to us about festivals, because it's like festival time of the year, but I feel there's some missing festivals.
Some missing festivals. We should have some more.
Yeah.
Extras in.
There should always be more festivals.
Always should be more. Well, it's really interesting, because when I was thinking about this, I was kind of been pondering it over a few days after you asked me about coming onto the show, was the realisation that a lot of the festivals in ancient Egypt, much like ours, are seasonal. So, and they actually follow the seasonality the same way that we do. So you basically, in ancient Egypt, you have three main seasons. You have Arket, which is the inundation when the land's all flooded. You have Peret, which is the growth season. So after the flood recedes, you plant everything and it all grows. And then you have Shemi, which is the harvest season. So obviously during certain times of the year, you can't do as much. And particularly during the inundation season, you can't really farm because the farmland's all flooded for a certain amount of time. And that's also the hottest time of the year. So people are less likely to want to do work. So interesting enough, that's kind of when a lot of the big festivals actually happen, was during that season. Because for us, the middle of winter, obviously in New Zealand, we do our Christmas at a weird time of year for us Northern Hemisphere types. But obviously, traditionally, part of Christmas was the celebration of the winter solstice, but it was a time when you weren't farming because the ground was frozen and it was cold. You didn't necessarily want to be outside doing stuff. Kind of in Egypt, it's almost the opposite. It's too hot to go out and do stuff. So it's a perfect time for you to have a festival. And obviously, again, the other thing is that when it's really hot, because obviously in Egypt, they didn't have the option to keep things cool or chill them down, you'll be getting through a lot of your food stuff before they went off. So again, it's another opportunity to kind of, you know, eat things whilst they were still there before it got to the point where you couldn't use them up anymore. So the Egyptians famously had a huge amount of festivals each year. So every town, village, small place, city would have their own temples, they would have their own traditions, and they would celebrate these, much like we would have, you know, now saints days and things like that, or your local church might have a church fete, that kind of thing. And so some festivals would be just local events and some would be national events, depending on what was going on. Much again, really similar to what we do now. And similarly, you would be allowed, you know, you would get time off work. You would be a day off labouring because it was a festival day. So certain things would become kind of a bigger deal in the calendar year, and certain things you would know when they were going to happen. So you might have, like, say, local events. So you'd have the equivalent of, you know, your anniversary day and Anzac Day and things that happen just here. And then you would have these big national events, which would be things for us like the equivalent of Christmas and Easter and those kind of things. So it does vary according to kind of time of year, where you are, that kind of stuff, which is quite, you say, it kind of is really similar to what we do in lots and lots of ways.
It's kind of fascinating how you get that view of the sort of the consistency of, you know, humans being humans and, mm-hmm. and doing those human sort of societal and cultural things.
Yeah.
And you get that comes through quite strongly in that Egyptian history where it's documented. Mm-hmm. Conveniently, the Egyptians wrote so much down for.
Well, this is the thing. This is one of the joys of ancient Egypt, is they did love bureaucracy and writing stuff down. The thing is that we've kind of had to, archaeologically, we've only in the last couple of decades come to terms with the fact that we can't learn everything we want to know about ancient Egypt from what they wrote down. So then you get the thing where you're kind of looking at the archaeological and the physical evidence and seeing if you can get that to actually match up with what you're seeing written down or depicted in tombs. Or the one thing that really helps us with this kind of thing, though, is because the Egyptians, in order to have a centralized society, so in order to be able to run the country under a single monarch, they had to have a really good centralized bureaucracy. They had to have a great civil service. And in order to do that, you've got to be able to record where things are coming and going from. You've got to be able to kind of basically keep track of goods and things. So they love to label things. So we do, for example, have, you know, labeled wine jars that tell us where the wine came from, what year it was made, all of this kind of stuff. So we can track things through that. And then what we can do is we can actually, you know, analyze the contents of the wine jars to see what they were actually making their wine from, what they were making their beers from and things. So, yeah, luckily, I say bureaucracy is a wonderful thing as long as you do it in a way that can be recorded and last for several millennia. It's all good by us. We're happy with it.
And as long as you don't just sort of unwind it and throw it all in the bin and give it to Peter Thiel.
If you've got to give us archaeologists something to do, so you can't make it too easy. So you can bin a few things if you want. Just make sure you leave us a few clues. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's sort of quite interesting about the seasons, that you've got a hot and wet season.
Mm-hmm.
So almost like a sort of monsoony kind of weather. And no cold season?
No, their idea of a cold season is our idea of a nice summer.
Yeah.
So, I was actually, funnily enough, thanks to the joys of modern technology, I can chat via WhatsApp and things with friends in Egypt. And I had a friend in Egypt the other day who was teasing me mercilessly because I was talking about how it was summer Christmas over here and that it was nice warm weather and it was like 22 degrees. And she was like, 22 degrees is, you know, coat and jumper weather to me in Egypt. That's ridiculous. In southern Egypt, around modern Luxor, you would expect the summer weather to be up, you know, 40 centigrade plus easily. So between 15 and 20 degrees centigrade is kind of their midwinter. So now Egypt is experiencing winter. It's the high season for tourism because it is cooler. But obviously during the summer, they didn't actually have the rain. So it wasn't a rainy season. It was a wet season because what would happen was as the weather got warmer, down in the south, the snow on the mountains south of Egypt would melt, and that would cause the river level to rise because obviously the Nile flows from the south up to the Mediterranean coast. And as that river level went up with the snow melt, that would cause the flooding.
Ah.
And that was the flooding that enabled, because the flooding brought with it all this good sediment and all this good stuff from in the mountains, that would create this kind of whole new layer of good, fresh growing soil. So that was why it worked for them. It's kind of this amazing thing where there's a country without rain is one of the best places for agriculture in the ancient world because of this annual flooding.
Hmm.
They didn't have to, yeah, as long as the flood didn't go either too high or too low, they could kind of pretty much be really accurate about how much they would be able to grow the following year. So you say, but like I say, well, the ground's flooded, you can't do anything with it. And like for us, it would be if the ground was frozen, you can't do anything with it. So they can go and do other things. And again, it's really interesting because there's other parallels you get here. So that would be, I'm not going to get into the nuances and complications of the Egyptian calendar as it relates to the actual solar calendar. But basically, the ancient Egyptian year began with the flood. They consider that to be the beginning of the year. And that would normally happen in mid-July. So in an interesting way, it ties in a bit with Matariki here. So there's kind of all these odd overlaps. So their new year would begin kind of early July to mid-July. And they would then have this whole series of festivals, including one which was called the opening of the year, which is basically a new year festival. They had in the first month of that season, so each season was divided into 4 months, they had 5 major festivals just in the first month. So that period between kind of mid-July to mid-August were 5 major festivals. And then they had 5 more major festivals over the course of the next 3 months. So in between that, you would have had kind of smaller bits and pieces going on. But that was kind of the busiest time of the year. And then obviously in the period later on when it's the harvesting season, there are fewer festivals because they need people to actually be out and be busy. But it's that kind of, you know, an element of keeping people happy, celebrating the fact that floods happen, celebrating this means that you will have food later in the year. All of these things combining together to make this kind of the best time of year to actually enjoy yourself.
Morning. This is...
Nice, we do thank you. Posterity will be proud of you. And perhaps you'd like to help us even more now by joining in the last chorus of this next song. Don't have to if you don't want to, you know, if it embarrasses you. Would be rather a pity if you don't sing tonight, I think, because tonight, by way of encouragement, attendants will be passing among you with rawhide whips. This is one of the first songs that Donald and I ever wrote together. It turned out to be a very lucky day for us.
Oh, most fortunate, my dear chap.
Certainly was, wasn't it? Today, of course, is also another rather splendid day. Today is the 50th anniversary of that marvellous day when Aloykin, the Russian chess master, played King's Pawn to Knight 7th. This caused quite a stir as they were playing bridge at the time. But, in honour of this, and because I can't think of any other way to get around it, Donald is going to sing the second chorus of this song in Russian. This is the very first of the animal songs. Some people think the title of this song is irrelevant. But it's not irrelevant, it's a hippopotamus.
A bone hippopotamus was standing one day on the banks of the cool Shalimar. He gazed at the bottom as it peacefully lay by the light of the evening star. Away on a hilltop sat combing her hair his fair hippopotamine maid. The hippopotamus was no ignoramus and sang her this sweet serenade. Mud, mud, glorious mud, nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. So follow me, follow, down to the hollow, and there let us wallow in glorious mud. The fair hippopotamus he aimed to entice from her seat on that hilltop above. As she hadn't got a ma to give her advice, came tiptoeing down to her love. Like thunder, the forest re-echoed the sound of the song that they sang as they met. His inamorata adjusted her garter and lifted her voice in duet in Russian.
Gnaz, gnaz, чудних грез, лучше средства, как корзная баз, так возьми свою даму.
Follow me, follow.
И поведи ее в яму.
Down to the hollow.
И там мы окунемся в чудную грязь.
There to improve our cultural relations. I wonder now what am I to say of the sea that ensued by the Shalimar side. They dived all at once with an ear-splitting splosh, then rose to the surface again. A regular army of hippopotami, all singing this haunting refrain. That's you!
Festivals maybe as a start of a 10. Mm-hmm. One was that there was a festival that you mentioned that involved everybody being raucous and drinking and
yep.
partying up.
It's very, very explicitly named the Festival of Intoxication or Drunkenness. So there was no kind of second guessing about what was meant to be happening in that one. Yeah. And again, that was in the first month of the flood season. So it'd be one of the things that would happen quite early on in the year.
Mm.
And that was a really interesting one because it's based around this quite spectacular myth about the... sorry, I'm umming a lot. It was based around a myth around a goddess Hathor, who's one of my favourite goddesses. She's a goddess of all sorts of things. She does everything from welcoming you into the world to welcome you into the afterlife and keeping an eye on you whilst you're alive and keeping an eye on turquoise miners and all sorts of things. But she's also a goddess of music and intoxication and general joyousness, having fun. And this comes from ancient Egyptian myth where she is sent by her father. Her father, who is the sun god, the creator god, has decided that he's had enough of the human race in this context just being the Egyptians, and that he wants to get rid of them. He's created them, they're not really serving any useful purpose. Yeah, so he's going to get rid of them. And what he does is he sends his daughter Hathor to basically destroy the human race. That's it, just kill them all off, we're done, I don't need them anymore, get rid of them. And she comes to Egypt. Bear in mind, the ancient Egyptians believed the gods kind of could reside in all sorts of different places. They could be wherever they felt like. So she comes to Egypt, and Hathor is often depicted as a woman with cow's ears or cow's horns, because she is associated with the cow in some different things. But Egyptian deities can transform into different beings according to what they want to be. They're not a static thing. And in order to do this, she transforms into a lioness, because lionesses are quite good at killing things, and starts the process of killing everybody. As you know, the sun god then thinks maybe he might have been a little bit rash and that he doesn't really want to kill off the whole of humanity. So he sends another couple of gods down to stop her. But the process of stopping someone once they've made their mind up can be quite challenging, and when they're following what they've been told to do. So the way that they stop her is they say to her, okay, you've been sent down to kill the whole human race. Do you have to do it all now? Or could you do some maybe tomorrow or later on? You know, there's no rush. There's not a time level on this. So they say, you know what, why don't you just take a break, sit down, we'll have a couple of drinks, have a chit-chat, and you can carry on later. So she says, yeah, okay, sounds good to me. And what they do is they actually deliberately, there are various versions of this myth, but the most popular one is that they very deliberately get her completely blackout drunk. absolutely sloshed. And when she's absolutely blackout drunk, what they do is they take a whole load of ancient Egyptian beer and they put red colouring dye in it and they pour that all over Egypt. And when she wakes up, she sees all of this beer and goes, or sees all this red liquid all over Egypt and says, well, what happened last night? I don't remember. And they go, oh, well, you killed everybody. And she's like, did I? Yeah, yeah, because look, there's blood everywhere. Clearly, you've killed everyone. So she goes, oh, take your word.
Done. For it.
Yeah, job done. Brilliant. I'll go home then. The story gets a bit more complicated after that point. But the whole point being is that basically, because Hathor got drunk, the human race survived. So the part of this festival is that kind of, you know, getting drunk and having fun is, well, yeah, okay, we'll celebrate our lives that way. The other thing, because the goddess Hathor is associated with fertility and birth and childbirth, obviously when people have had a few drinks, they tend to get a little bit frisky at times. And if you're lucky, you know, several months later, you might end up with some more kids. So it was also considered to be kind of, you know, a festival that was an opportunity to, you know, let your hair down, maybe end up with some extra kids at the end of it. All good. The goddess, the gods and the goddesses will be happy with you for this, you know. And then if you get your timing right, then hopefully the babies will be born just before in the early part of the harvest season and it won't get in the way too much of everything and off you go again. So, yeah, it's kind of really interesting that this is one of the things when they were actively encouraged to kind of, you know, you can go out, get sloshed, do what you want. All bets are off tonight.
It gets, so it comes after she thought that radio job done. Mm-hmm. I've killed off everybody. Now everybody will have a party, which is it's a bit hard case, isn't it?
Bit hard case. It gets a bit complicated because she figures out that she's been tricked and that she hasn't done what she's done. She does somewhat lose her temper with her dad about the whole thing, and it does result in the lioness goddess becoming a permanent fixture in the Egyptian cosmology. So this basically the part of her that becomes so angry that the lioness kind of becomes a permanent thing. But again, the goddess Hathor, as I say, she's a lot of fun, Hathor, in lots of ways, but she's the goddess where if she's happy, it's great. If you upset her, you really don't want to deal with the consequences of what happens if you make her angry. So, yeah, so it's all around this idea that maybe, you know, let's celebrate getting drunk, because if this goddess hadn't got drunk, we wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Yeah.
So when did that festival happen? Obviously during the rainy...
That festival happens during the course, say, of the first month of the flood. So it's part of the kind of the same month as the, it would be probably late July, early August. Yeah, around that time, maybe mid-August. So, yeah, again, at the kind of hottest part of the year, that point of the year, it'll be around probably between 40 and 50 degrees centigrade in Egypt, in the south. Not quite so hot in the north, but still pretty darn hot.
So, yeah, it's kind of, you know, as a kid, you know, see these pictures of Egypt, and it's obviously really hot. It's obviously really deserty, and thinking, well, but here was this huge fertile river plain, which I keep saying that it's rainy, but it's not rainy. It's come from the melt. So I never realised that.
Which is really funny, because that's the thing. If you look at satellite pictures of Egypt, you will see literally there's just this green stripe that goes down through the middle. And then the rest of it is just... And you can go to Egypt, and because it is now, obviously, the flood is more controlled and the water's more controlled, there isn't a flood anymore. It's all controlled by the dams and things. But you can literally stand with one foot in a field and the other foot in desert.
Yeah.
Because the water cannot expand beyond where... it's controlled to, there's no kind of randomness to it. It can be really carefully controlled now.
I was kind of...
She was a playboy, Bridget Bardot. She showed me things I didn't know. She did it right there, out on the deck. Put her canine teeth in the side of my neck. Girl in the hallway, waiting for
is Festival of Intoxication.
It's called the Festival of Intoxication or Drunkenness.
Another one that you mentioned, is it Opet?
Yes.
Yeah.
Big E. That's the biggest one of them all, really.
And
so the Opet Festival, again, this happens in the second month of the flood season. So this would have been probably from maybe late August, that kind of time in our calendar. Their calendar still would have been really hot, still would everything would have been flooded. But the Opet Festival, which became very popular, particularly during the New Kingdom. So the New Kingdom is the period of Egyptian, ancient Egyptian history when you have all of the people that we've heard of, you know, Tutankhamun, Queen Hatshepsut, all of those people were during the New Kingdom. And that's when a lot of the big buildings that we know about that are still standing were built. So the big temples, the Valley of the Kings was built during this period. And what they have then down in what is now Luxor, but to the ancient Egyptians was a city that the Greeks referred to as Thebes in Egypt. They had the major god, so the main god of Egyptian cosmology had changed slightly because of the politics had changed. And at this point, the most important god in the Egyptian religion was a god called Amun. And Amun is the hidden god. He's all places at all times. He's the air around you, all of these things. And Amun was the divine father of the rightful monarch of Egypt. So the way the myth went was that how a monarch was born, a pharaoh was born, was that their mother was visited by Amun in the form of their father. So she didn't know that she was, you know, having a bit of a fling with a god. She thought she was having a fling with her husband, but it was Amun in disguise. And then that child would go on to become the rightful king. And Amun's main temple was a temple which we know now as the Temple of Karnak, which is absolutely huge, biggest, one of the biggest religious buildings in the world. And each king would add a bit to this. And once a year, the way that the Egyptians didn't believe the gods would lurk about, but what they would have is they would have an image of the god, a statue of the god, much like in a church we would have a crucifix or an image of a saint or something like that. And once a year, the image of the god, it would be Amun, his consort, the goddess Mut, and their child, the god Khonsu, would leave their temple at Karnak, and they would travel to another smaller temple about 2 kilometers away called the Temple of Luxor. And at the Temple of Luxor, they would meet with the reigning monarch, the pharaoh, and that time that the Amun would basically re-welcome his child and reinstate the fact that this child was the rightful monarch of Egypt. And the reason this was important is the two main reasons are, one, it's one of the only opportunities that most people would have to see the god, because the god's image would leave the temple and have to travel through the town or along the river. And the other thing was the king would always be in attendance. So technically the king was meant to be in attendance at every festival, but obviously they can't be everywhere all the time. But this one, the monarch would actually have to be there. So it became this massive, massive event. And the monarch wouldn't live in that area. So they'd also have to travel from the north down to the south to get there. So you'd have all of these events that would happen all along the way as the royal court stopped en route. Because you imagine it would take them, you know, several days, if not weeks, to travel south. And they would stop and there would be big festivals, everyone. And when they actually got then finally to Thebes, to this where they would be, the festival itself there would last for, the early records have it down as being about 11 days, but then by the end of the 20th dynasty, it was going up to 27 days long that this festival would run, so one city. So you can imagine the amount of kind of, there's the whole royal court, there are all of the entertainers, there are all of the officials, there's all of the military. It's a huge, huge, massive event. An opportunity for people to see the pharaoh, to see the gods, to actually have any kind of interaction with the pharaoh and the gods. Because normally the gods were locked away inside their temples. You didn't really see them. You only saw them via the priests. So this was, you know, the big event of the year. And it involved because the gods were traveling, they would be have to be entertained. So you'd have dancers, musicians, you would have obviously people selling food, people feasting, you would have places where the gods would stop, where you could again have there'd be more dancers and celebrations there. You would have had athletics competitions, wrestling contests, all of these things. And also later on, certain parts of the temple that were normally closed off to the public would be opened up to the public. So it'd be one time that you could actually kind of go inside. It would be like being allowed inside a cathedral that you weren't normally allowed in. Not just that, on top of all of that, obviously there's huge amounts of food, drink, all of this stuff that's up to good enough standard for the gods and for the kings, which would then be shared with the people around there. Because, you know, you can't eat all of it. And it, part of the king's duty would be, or the monarch's duty would be, to show, you know, share things with the people, show that they're worthy of the people's love, all of this stuff. So again, kind of this massive thing just designed to reinforce the fact that the king was the rightful king. People get to see. So just, yeah, absolutely huge event. And they also would have sometimes travel across to the west bank of the river where the Valley of the Kings was and visit some of the temples there. So again, all of those temples then would have these big festivals and celebrations, and then all the people around there would get to share the food. So yeah, absolutely massive, massive event. And obviously you allowed time off work for this as well. So if you were employed there, you wouldn't be expected to be, you know, doing something on the day that the gods were traveling and that the king was in town. So yeah, absolutely. That was kind of the one thing. And we know a lot about it because it was Tutankhamun, interestingly enough, did a huge amount of decoration in one of the temples, the Luxor temple, actually depicting this whole procession and how it worked. So we did get a lot of information from that. You can still see that now if you go if you're lucky enough to ever visit the temple.
So the form of the gods that people were getting to see mm-hmm. was in the form of the people who were the royalty who had that descent?
No, they would get to what each temple, the way it was, is an interesting thing. So say the Egyptians, from what we can tell, didn't believe that a statue was a god, but they believed that the god would be able to inhabit that statue if they needed to.
Because they can shift form.
Yeah, exactly. So if the god needed to take on some kind of physical form, it could inhabit the statue. So the temple, each temple would have statues of the god that that temple was dedicated to. The temple was effectively their house. And the offerings would be made to the statue on the understanding that the god would be able to basically inhabit the statue and accept the offerings via that form. So what would happen? Normally the statue is locked away in the sanctuary, so the most private part of the temple. But what would happen on these days is that those statues would be taken out of the temple and placed on what's effectively a very big model boat, which could be carried by priests. It had these kind of wooden bars on it. So the priests would put the statue of the gods in their particular royal yachts or divine yachts and then carry them between the temples, which is why they'd have to have these stopping points because these things were really heavy. You had to put them down every once in a while. And then they would, on the return journey, they would actually put them on a proper royal boat and sail them back down the river to the other temple. Yeah, it was
Holding
almost
them
like...
the upriver would be quite challenging because it's in flood.
Well, this is the thing as well, because we know later on that they did used to travel in both directions by river. But going upriver, because of the challenge, they used to have basically these massive groups of men along the side of the river with ropes, literally dragging these big kind of bordering on yachts, kind of small ships up the river. So they could sail it back down, but dragging it up. And I don't know why they decided this was a good idea, but they decided it was. Maybe it was just kind of a security issue. You're less likely to be rushed by crowds if you're on a boat. But this would be one of the only times when you could literally see the god going past. And so you could then, you know, kind of pray to them directly. And as I say, it would be that considered this statue as a conduit between you and the god rather than that kind of, you know, the direct the being itself. But they would still, because of this, because it is this conduit, they would still make all of the offerings, have all of the things they would be giving to the god, working on the theory that the god can then receive them kind of through mystical means rather than actually coming and consuming them. But again, obviously, if you're making all of these offerings, it's the hottest time of the year. You've got all of this food. You've got meat. You've got fish. You've got poultry, waterfowl. You've got fruit, all of these things. No refrigeration. So do you just leave it there to rot, or do you then, the god has taken their sustenance from it, so you then distribute it amongst the people around you? So again, it's kind of, you know, almost a charitable event in some ways.
Yeah, you get to eat the leftovers.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing that's really interesting is one of the most common offerings made to gods is actually flowers. The Egyptians loved giving flowers. And we did have one record at one point, this main temple of Amun at Karnak, someone, we found a record of the amount of floral donations that had been made over the course of, I think it was 3 years, and it was 4.75 million floral donations in forms of bouquets and bunches of flowers and all of these things. Flowers are like a really, because flowers bloomed and then died, they thought it was kind of a real sign of renewal and vitality. So yeah, it's kind of quite an interesting whole mix of bits and pieces.
It's interesting where flowers are quite popular through various religious things, but the thinking about why varies a bit, but quite a lot of it's to do with, you know, the flower starts out as this beauty thing and then dies.
But then reappears the next year.
And then next year there's more.
Yeah, yeah. And the Egyptians were very into that whole idea of the annual renewal cycle. And this was all part of it. The flood was the thing that you knew that the renewal cycle was beginning again. This was the start of the cycle of rejuvenation, renewal, fertility, all of this stuff was happening at that point of the year. So it was really important to them.
So I think one of the interesting things is that Opet's continued to this day, I believe.
Sorry?
Has Opet continued?
No, it's not. But it's, like I say, we still have the actual record of it. Some of the ancient Egyptian festivals, much like, you know, in northern tradition, some of the ancient Egyptian festivals have morphed into modern religious festivals, the same things kind of doing at the same times. But yeah, they don't think there's any ones that actually are literally the same anymore.
In the same form?
No.
Are there any other festivals that you've had come to mind in the last few days?
The other big one, one of the other big popular ones, was one called the Beautiful Feast of the Valley. And the Beautiful Feast of the Valley took place, again, in Luxor, the Luxor region. And that was on the West Bank. And what that was that the same gods, Amun. And again, we have the records of this because this is what survives. You know, archaeologically, whatever is most recent, it's got a better chance of survival. So we have the New Kingdom records. During this festival, the gods would leave their temples on the East Bank at Luxor and travel to the West Bank, where the mortuary temples of the kings were and where the Valley of the Kings is and the cemeteries were. The idea being that the West was where you descended into the, as the sun set and when it descended into the afterlife. So that's where you would go. And the mortuary temples are, again, these huge temples built by the New Kingdom pharaohs. And these temples were designed so that the king could still be worshipped after their death as part of the kind of life cycle of the monarchy. And so it was almost like kind of a Day of the Dead. And it was a time when people would go and visit the graves of their ancestors, and they would have basically a picnic and have a little celebration at the gravesite and offer food and share their meals with their, you know, granny and granddad and great granny and granddad and whatever it was and who these people were. So that was another kind of quite interesting festival. And that was, when was the Beautiful Feast of the Valley? Let me have a look. That was actually during the harvest period, the second month. So when there was food was kind of plentiful is when they would do that. So we'd have a day doing that. The other thing that's really interesting is kind of what they actually used to do in terms of these festivals. Like I say, we've talked about, you know, intoxication and drunkenness. But I don't think people often really think about what they were consuming at the time. So, I mean, obviously now Egypt is a majority Muslim country, so there's not much in the way of alcohol consumed there at all. But the ancient Egyptians, famously, their diet was founded on two things, which were bread and beer. And the reason they were founded, so the ancient Egyptians didn't have money. They didn't use currency the way that we do. Their currency was effectively grain or whatever they could grow. So if you worked, if you weren't a farmer or you weren't in agriculture, you would be paid in grain, wheat and barley. And the things you, the reason you were paid in those is because you could make two things out of them, which were bread and beer. So it'd make bread dough. Some of the bread would be partly baked and that would be used, then broken up and fermented in water to make beer. And the beer that they had was kind of a, it wasn't beer as we know it. It was more of a kind of thick, slightly gruely, alcoholic gruel. But that meant it would have actually had quite a high nutritional value because it would have had carbohydrate and sugar and vitamins and whatever in it. And obviously they could flavour it with anything they wanted and it would store better than water. And we found there's no standard recipe for beer in ancient Egypt because everyone would just make their own. It's like homebrew. But what we found through, luckily through a place, there's a place called Deir al-Medina, which is where the people that built the Valley of the Kings lived. And one of the big advantages of this place is that everyone, most people could read and write. And one of the things that we found from there, which is now in the British Museum, is a quite a big chunk of pottery, which they'd used as a work record. It was literally an attendance record, you know, who was here, who wasn't here. And if someone was absent from work for whatever reason, they would mark on it in red that they were absent and why they were absent. And you could be absent for all sorts of reasons. You know, your wife's having a baby. This has happened. That's happened. And one of the reasons that's recorded for absence is making beer. But making beer for a festival. So our theory is that this particular person was probably the person who made the best beer in the village. And so when there was a festival coming up, you know, what's his face from around the corner from number 10 would be, go, right, you make beer for everybody. Your stuff's really good. We'll give you 3 days off work. Off you go. But it was like a legitimate reason to not be at work. So he's got a job to do. And the beer could be flavoured with, I mean, obviously they have dates out there. They, at this point, they would have had pomegranates. They had different herbs and spices they could have put in the beer for different flavours. They could probably vary the strength according to what was going on. If you were really fancy and you had money, you might be able to afford wine. So wine did exist, but wine was more, and wine has existed right from the beginning of Egyptian history, but it's more expensive because it's much more labour intensive to make and to produce. So bearing in mind you've got a country where there's not rain, it's just flood water. In order to grow vines, you have to water them really regularly. Yeah. So you've got to be able to afford to pay someone to carry water from the river twice a day. So having a vineyard is a big status symbol. You've then got to pay for the, you know, making wine. You've got to pick the grapes. You've got to, you know, tread the grapes. You've got to store it. You've got to do all of this stuff. Again, expensive, labor-intensive process. So they would have had wine as well, but that would have been much more kind of, I think there was one thing that someone found, there was a record someone found that suggested that wine was 5 times more expensive than beer. So beer wasn't free, but wine was expensive. But again, so they would have had, at festivals would have been the time that you would have had maybe some wine instead as a special treat, which you could have, and they would have made wine from not just grapes, but they also made date wine, obviously pomegranate wine when they had pomegranates later on, fig wine because they had figs growing naturally. So all of these sorts of things. And then also they would have used the dates and the figs and the pomegranates to sweeten cakes and breads and things to make kind of nice treats. So again, all of these things kind of, you know, the seasonality thing for them. Obviously, that's kind of fig season that time of year. So you're going to be really going great guns. Yeah, so they would have really kind of taken advantage of the fact that these things were there and available and they could use them.
And that's a seasonal one-off, isn't it? Your fruit is ready now.
Yeah. Exactly.
Whereas your grain?
Gone. That's it. And so, yeah, the grain was all year round, but having the different things to flavour it with. And if you were really, really fancy and you had real, you know, a lot of assets available, you could actually have bees and beehives and you'd have honey. Mm. But that was, you know, again, you had to have the resources to be able to maintain that. So it wasn't as common a thing. Yeah, that would be like for real special occasions would be honey and nice wine.
Well, thank you, Sarah. There's a certain joy in hearing about those festivals for me, because you know, it's how people adapt to their environment and their.
Well, I think they're also a really important tool of social cohesion.
Mm.
Now, the whole one of the big things is that there's, I think that people forget sometimes is that there's oftentimes no point in having people in charge if they can't do anything for you. And one of the things they can do for you is give you treats and give you holidays.
Mm.
You know, part of the thing with being a pharaoh in ancient Egypt wasn't just that you got to boss everyone around and get them to build massive temples and dig great tombs for you. It's that you could then also gift things to the people, including having festivals and celebrations and giving out wine and beer and all sorts of lovely things. I mean, another one of the major festivals that would happen only occasionally, so it was a really special occasion, was a festival called the Sed Festival, which was a jubilee festival celebrating 30 years of a monarch's reign. So if they were on the throne for 30 years, they could have a Sed Festival. And during this, we think part of it was they had to prove that they were sort of fit enough physically to rule the country. So they'd make them do things like do a running race or something, run around a course. But those were massive, massive events, because obviously it was this kind of, you know, it's like having a golden jubilee or a silver jubilee for a monarch. So again, and the monarch then would be part of their duty would be to, you know, give things to the people. So, yeah, it's all kind of that way to keep society functioning and cohesive is to give people unifying events.
Thanks, Sarah, for that interview about the festivals of Egypt. It's that time of year, eh?
The program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.